Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled The Economics of Children. Recorded in 1995, Dr. James M. Buchanan, Harris University professor at George Mason University, and Dr. Jennifer Robach Morse, associate professor of economics at George Mason University, discuss how children develop as economic thinkers and become decision makers. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Well, I appreciate, Jenny, I appreciate your willingness to come and participate in these academic conversations. I know that you have recently been interested in and actually have organized a conference on the what we might call the economics of children or the economics of the child. And I think you do bring us all up short initially when we even start thinking about that, because I'm as guilty as most economists are that we sort of start out and assume that we're dealing with a set of fully grown people, and we never really talk at all about the fact that we are born, we grow up as children, and then we die. And certainly that's true of my own work in sort of extending economics over into politics, sort of contractarian political philosophy. We just assume everybody is full grown and never dies. So I think this is an open area that I'm pleased to see you developing. And I'd like to just get lead you on to sort of speculate a little bit, or tell us a little bit about what your project is and how you're approaching this, and then we'll get off into some of the more specific aspects.
Well, as you say, I think it's a central fact that we're born helpless, that we're not born as fully competent, contracting, choosing agents the way economics always assumes and as political philosophy always assumes. So the fact of helplessness is, in a sense, the most universal fact about human persons, because everybody goes through the experience of being a baby. So what I have been trying to do is to deal with the fact that people we can't assume that people are totally autonomous at all times, because there's a period, obviously, in everybody's life where they're not autonomous, where they're totally dependent on others. And I'm looking at that period to see just what it is that's important and what turns out to be important for economics and for political philosophy. Now, the first thing that I really work with and deal with is the issue of trust, and the fact that the person in their helplessness has to learn to trust in order to get the help that they need in order just to survive. And the children who don't get that turn out to have some very serious problems. Children who are either neglected or abused and then turn out to not be very trusting or trustworthy, they tend to turn out to be very calculating people who almost look like a caricature of homo economicus, the person who is always out for themselves and never thinking of anyone else and never willing to inconvenience themselves for anybody else. They don't have any moral sense that includes other people. And that's a central, of course, you know, as you know from your work, that sort of sense of shared community and willingness to cooperate with others is a central background fact of what's going to make any society work. It's what holds an economy together. It's what holds a political community together. If everybody is being opportunistic every chance they get, things will go to pieces pretty quickly.
And this is quite different, isn't it, but it's related to it, to the formation of preferences. I know you're interested in that, but this is somewhat different from essentially, as you say, we're not fully autonomous choosing agents from the time we're born. Our preferences, economists like to take preferences as given, but these preferences are themselves formed in some sort of a process. But what you're talking about is quite different from that. That's an aspect of
right.
economics of children, but the development of trust is in one sense prior to, but it is different from
yes,
that.
That's quite true. Now, the reason I got interested in the question of how preferences are formed, or that whole problem of the self, is that I had a student, a very smart student, when I was at Cornell, who said to me, you know, the reason I went into law school instead of economics is because I just thought that something was wrong with economics because somewhere somebody has to take responsibility for the content of the self. And I thought, you know, gee, we lost another smart student to law school. And he was right. That kid's remark was completely correct, that we do have somebody somewhere in the system has to take responsibility for the formation of the self and the preferences. So part of the problem is, whose problem is it? That's one question. Is this a big social problem where society at large is to be responsible, both in the sense of doing the work and in the sense of bearing the costs and reaping the benefits? Well, in some sense, society plays a role. But as we know, if we collectivize something like that, then it's not going to get done very well if we say it's society's problem. So it's necessary that responsibility be localized to the parent initially, and then ultimately to the person themselves as they mature, as they become capable of taking that responsibility for themselves. So the preference, the problem of forming the self is something that that initially parents have a huge role in, but ultimately the person themselves has to take some charge of. And so for me, what's at stake here is that I think the ordinary model of economic behavior, of economic man, has the preferences as given, as you say. It's almost like the person is a given from outside the system. That crucial point about who the person is predetermined. It's almost like a kind of predestination position. And, you know, economics doesn't take a position on whether it's genetics or whatever it might be, but it's somehow given and we don't concern ourselves with it. And a person that's given in that way seems to me that's not an agent in the same way. All that person does is respond to prices. You know, and you know that you've made this critique yourself, you know, that this isn't really choosing in any meaningful sense. This is a person who's just reacting to stimuli that come in, oh, price, oh, income, oh, I change, you know, that kind of thing. That's all the person can do in that model. And so what I want to try to introduce is the fact that every person is in fact a choosing agent in a deeper way. That is, they choose the content of their preferences. They have some help when they're little, but then ultimately there's a stage where we have to do some reflecting for ourselves and take some responsibility for that.
Well, I can see, and this is a very important area, and I want to get back to that, but I want to go back a little earlier to what you said. How does this itself, I can see the problem that you raised, that somebody must be responsible for the formation of the self, and it's very important, and whether this be done through the collective or whether it be done through families or through institutions, that's a very important area. Maybe we'll come back to it in a minute, but I want to tied into what you said earlier about this trust relationship.
Okay.
That's not quite the same thing.
No, it's not identical at all.
Yeah. And in a sense, what you say, it seems to me, about this trust relationship, that is, if a child does not develop this sense of trust, this interaction with other people that embodies some trust, then that child can still, a self can be formed. With a lot of these qualities that you mentioned by some group, but unless that trust is there, a certain element is lacking.
Yes, I think that's right. And here's what I mean. Here's what I think it is, Jim, that's missing. It's not simply that they don't trust the other person, although that's a big element of it. Mm-hmm. It's that they're not attached enough to other people to allow other people to matter to them very much. And part of that is trust. I mean, the fact that they don't trust means that they won't connect to other people and allow the other person to be important, because that person could be withdrawn or turn on them or whatever their experience might have been. So that kind of person who's not connected to other people, who's not attached to other people, that's your kind of dangerous person who can't be controlled through anything other than external costs and benefits and sanctions that other people impose on them. If they think they can get away with something, they'll get away with it. They'll go ahead and try, you know. And persons who are not, who don't have anything internalized, you know, here's the claim, and this is not a claim unique to me. This is a claim that you find made among child development specialists who work with these disturbed kids, is that children who do not have who do not have the capacity to attach or connect to other people, those children have a very difficult time ever restraining themselves or even inconveniencing themselves for the sake of other people. you know, they don't really internalize self-control in the same way other people do. That seems to be a key element. And I thought that was a very interesting thing for economics to be aware of.
Well, are you saying then, though, that this can be constructed, in other words, this can be constructed by someone? Or is this basically something that's genetically programmed, and if people don't have it, they don't have it?
Oh, I have never seen anybody claim that it's genetically programmed, that if they don't have it, they don't have it. The claim that I most often see in literature is that these are children who have been severely neglected, profoundly abused, this kind of thing. They have their reasons for not trusting anybody. They have their reasons for not connecting. So far as I know, I haven't seen people say, well, that's just a bad gene. I mean, there might be some people in that category, but by and large, what you're seeing, for instance, kids coming out of orphanages, kids coming out of foster care situations where they haven't connected to other people, where it doesn't make, you know, from their point of view, it doesn't make any sense to connect to anybody, or there's nobody there to connect with. That there's a process that goes on in the first 18 months of life that those kids miss, and it's a process that we all always take for granted in all of our analysis and all of our development and everything else. We just assume that people, you know, care if somebody says, oh, that's really awful and you shouldn't do that, that will have an impact on the other person, that will, you know, somewhere matter to them that other people
disagree. So go back to the larger point then. You're saying that this is an aspect where for those particular type of children where we have failed to construct the selves in the way that is necessary for them to be functioning members of a social order.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, and in other words, you can't assume that the baby is born ready to go. Somebody has to do something for them very early on, and if we don't do it, or if the relevant adults don't do it, if it's not done, you know, then the child, of course, has a lifetime problem that they have to deal with. But then so does everybody else. Everybody around them then has to deal with it.
Well, now this is closely related to the modern discourse and concern that many people express politically and otherwise about the failure of modern society to transmit values, or in the popular parlance, family values is an important issue.
Right.
It's closely related to that discussion, and people seem to have a sense that something's gone wrong, and they don't quite be able to articulate exactly what it is.
Well, I think one of the things that's gone wrong is that there is in the culture a sort of subterranean notion that the child is perfect unless adults goof it up somehow. You know, that you have this little noble savage that's born to you, that's a wonderful little child, wonderful, perfect being, and the reason people go wrong is because their parents mess up somehow, you know? Mm-hmm. So that if only we allow that perfect self to emerge, everything would be fine. And the best child rearing practice is one that doesn't suppress the child too much. I think that comes from Rousseau. I'm not sure who first invented that, but I mean, you know, this notion is kind of afoot. Well, you know, that it's plausible to think of a child as a noble savage when they're an infant, but when they hit about age 2 or 3, you know, it's no longer credible to believe that they're going to be perfect, no matter, you know. And so, therefore, I think that a lot of parents are almost intimidated by their children because the parents believe that all they can do is harm. By constraining the child too much, by repressing the child too much. Whereas, in fact, what I think is true is that the child is a savage. He's just not a noble savage. You know, he's a lovable little savage sometimes, but the child does have to have some help in maturing. They're not going to do it automatically, you know, and they don't instinctively know what is to be done. And indeed, it's a great disservice to the child to allow the child to make decisions, in effect, that are really adult decisions. I mean, I've seen households where the three-year-old runs a family. Yeah. Three-year-old decides when it's going to be bedtime and what they're going to have for dinner and when they're going to eat, so on and so forth, because the parents don't want to repress the child. So, at the heart of the quarrel about family values is that many adults are intimidated about taking their adult responsibility for the nurturance of the children. They don't see it as their duty or their responsibility. They see it as something where they can only make a mistake, you know, where they're going to be held liable if things go wrong. But it's not something where, you know, it's parents, I think, don't really have enough support for the understanding that they need to constrain their child. You know, they need to discipline the child. They need to direct the child. Child needs direction and guidance. And, you're afraid somebody's going to call Child Protective Services on you if you do what you think needs to be done, you know. So I do think that in my generation of people raising children have a very different problem to confront than my mother's generation or your mother's generation, you know, had to face. Because I think in earlier times, people understood that children have to be corrected. And that's harder for people. The ideology is kind of confusing for people.
Now, you, in some of your work, you've put this or developed these arguments in terms of these two things that people have, appetites and longings.
Okay.
And in one sense, you say that children are more likely to indulge appetites as opposed to longings, or another way of putting it, you might say they have higher discount rates, which we all know. You might just elaborate on that a little bit.
Okay.
That distinction.
Yeah. The in my theoretical work on these matters, what I've done is to say that the person has desire both for appetites, what we might consider the sort of ordinary consumption, the things that we kind of have in common with animals almost, the desire for food and clothing and shelter and gratification, amusement, that kind of thing. But they also have the desire for what we might call the longings, the deepest longings of the heart. And I put those in a separate category because I want to talk about them separately. The longings would be things like truth and beauty, friendship, love, those kind of things. And what I try to argue is that you need some material goods to satisfy those longings, but you can have too much material goods in relation to the optimal production of the longings. So you can get, an analogy would be a health analogy. Health would be a longing and food would be the appetite. You can easily overindulge in the food relative to its value in producing good health. You can overindulge in your desire for material things in relation to its your desire for friendship, for instance, or love, you know, or indulging the sexual appetite in relation to your desire for love. So the part of what I try to do with that is that is to say that the child needs help from their parents in understanding those distinctions, that not all consumption is equally valuable, in a sense. And what you can show, just from a technical point of view as an economist, what you can show is that we always assume more is preferred to less in economics. We always say more is better. But here you can readily show more is not better. Right, because you can have more food or more donuts or, you know, whatever, and make yourself worse off by consuming too much of something that turns out to be bad for you. So then you work up to the fact that the adult also has a problem, because adults have to manage that conflict or potential conflict between the appetites and the longings.
Yeah, my professor Frank Knight used to always say that what we really want is better wants.
Uh-huh.
And I think that is descriptive of what you're talking about. In a way, it's related to this notion of longings. But how is this related to, do you need this distinction in a way? Or I think it might be useful, but let me ask you this. How is it related to just simply the short-term versus the long-term interest?
Well, that's a very good question. Yeah. And I don't have that completely sorted out in my own mind, the short term versus the long term, that because there's obviously an element of timing in the whole thing, that you have immediate gratification versus long term cost. Mm-hmm. Most of the examples that I'm thinking about have that characteristic, that they're, you know, sort of immediate pleasure versus long term cost. Still, what you do need to be able to have an account of why there's a cost in the future, how it is that there's a cost in the future. And this little apparatus of the appetites and the longings is a way of doing that, is one way of doing that. I mean, you could do it all in terms of discount rates. My guess is you'd miss something by doing it that way. But these two problems are obviously very closely related. And this business of the discount rate is...
Yeah, well, as you know, we both read a fascinating book by a psychiatrist, George Ainslie, called Picoeconomics.
Uh-huh.
In which he argues, of course, that adults, children, doesn't matter. Within each of us, there are little men, or little women competing with each other,
right.
One of which has a very short-term interest and the other is a long-term interest.
Right.
And there's psychological evidence that not only animals do this, but persons at all stages, children and adults, simply are time inconsistent. That is, they will make a long-term plan, but then they will violate that as the temptation emerges.
Well, I see. I think this is a very interesting point, is the economics of temptation.
Yeah.
You see, because economists have a tendency to say, and you know some of these arguments, have a tendency to say, well, if you succumb to the temptation, that proves that that's what you really wanted to do, in some sense, because you weren't willing to bear the cost. Well, that's not too useful, I think, of a description of what's going on. And one thing that's interesting to me is that what Ainslie's work is suggesting, and what I think some of my work is starting to suggest to me, is that that directing your will to following your plan is not a costless activity. So the alcoholic knows he's got to stop drinking. He knows he's got a problem. It's not a problem of rationally calculating what he's supposed to do. He knows what he's supposed to do. But the problem is getting himself to do it and following through or directing his will to act in that way. That's costly. Well, in economics, we always assume that as soon as you've done the calculation, bam, you're done. That's all you have to do. The action's going to flow immediately out of that. And that's just not right. And Ainslie's story is a way of seeing that, too. There's a little continual quarrel going on internally, which at any time might go any way. And I think that's an interesting way of modeling the problem of the will.
So you're saying that weakness of will is a real problem for all of us.
I think it is. I think it is.
I
think it is. I mean, I think economists have sort of talked themselves out of believing that.
Yeah.
You know, some of the fellows at Chicago have these models of addiction, of rational addiction and so on. And, you know, I just can't believe anybody's really convinced by those models, you know, that it's rational to become addicted. And then, you know, when you decide it's time to become unaddicted, you become unaddicted. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a very costly process of becoming unaddicted, you know, and that's the reason it takes people so long to do it. And that's the reason it's such a trying business for everybody to do.
Well, I'd like to go back and try to relate this, and I'm not sure we can, but try to relate this in a way to what we were talking about earlier, and go back to your initial point about trust. One thing that occurred to me while we were talking about this was how does this relate to Hayek's distinction that Hayek makes? Hayek makes a distinction between the sort of natural proclivities or instincts or whatever you want to call them that emerge genetically, as it were, because we've evolved as members of tribal groups, and as opposed to the behavior that we face in a large interaction setting like a market, which requires a completely different sort of context. Now, to what extent has this problem of the breakdown of trust, generally speaking, or family values in a larger sense, not quite the same notion of trust that I'm think you're concentrating on and talking about how the baby develops trust, but the more general notion of sort of trust with people you know and with whom you interact. Now, Hayek emphasized that a lot of those attitudes we have are strictly limited in number in the sense that we are members of tribes. Genetically, we're members of tribes. Whereas trust in the sort of market sense, the sort of ethics of the marketplace that are required for what I call the great society, are quite different thing. Now, how does that relate back, or does it relate back at all to your...
Well, it does. It certainly does relate back, Jim. And I've thought about it quite a bit, actually, and I don't have a firm resolution about it. But one thing that I do think, or that I would say, is that I think Hayek may have exaggerated the extent to which you can have sort of a mass impersonal world. I mean, you know, there are wonderful things about the market, and there are wonderful things about the worldwide world that, you know, sort of cosmopolitan world that we live in. But that was held together, and that is held together. That can only be held together by persons who are connected at a personal level. It's a connection. I think it is a connection of smaller groups that are cemented together through something like family, more like the tribal bonds. So, in a sense, the challenge for Hayek would be, is it possible to have the great society without those tribal bonds? Is that possible? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking that it's not really possible. See, I think there was a liberal idea that you could bring everybody together in this sort of big liberal cosmopolitan world where one person would be as important to you as any other person, and you wouldn't have a lot of nationalism, you wouldn't have a lot of, you know, sort of local jealousies and that kind of thing. But I'm thinking now that our faith in that was exaggerated. You know, I think that you need some connection and attachment to particular people, particular places. You're from the South. You know that that's very important to Southerners, for example. It's a very important part of the Southern ethos is the connection to a particular place. And I really don't think you can get away from it completely. What I think has happened, where Hayek was, I think, on the right track with his distinction, is that it's possible to exploit those personal feelings and sort of use them up by creating a phony family, a phony great society, where we're trying to hold the American polity together because we're supposed to love each other. You know, that I think will not work. That will never work. The thing that will hold the United States of America together cannot be that we love everyone in it equally. Yeah. You know, that can never be. And attempting to do that, I think is in fact a contributing factor to why the real families are starting to break down, because we're giving over responsibilities to that collective that properly belong to the family. Therefore, the family doesn't have anything to do. Therefore, the family is weakened in significant ways. Now, one area that I know is of interest to you that I'll just throw in here as we close is a whole area of the family breakdown. One of the first welfare state programs that I personally think was very, very responsible for that is Social Security, because it took the adults out of the family, took the top of the family out of the family, because you're no longer responsible for your parents, and your parents are no longer dependent on you, and so grandma and grandpa live somewhere else, and we never see them, and we don't have any connection with them, and so that by the state collectivizing that part of family life has meant that part of family life has corroded. And we haven't noticed it because people haven't gone to pieces over it in the same way that they go to pieces if they lose their mother and father when they're little children, you know, then that's a much bigger problem, obviously. But I think I see Social Security as one piece of that bigger puzzle, you know, where we have step by step assigned responsibility to the collective and destroyed not only the private little family, but also we're destroying the collective by asking it to do things it can't do.
And the small group. I think this is right, and I think I agree fundamentally with the thrust of your remarks, and there's also something economics can say about this. To go back to the point about family and the transmission of values, the values which a family has an economic interest in transmitting is itself changed once you introduce Social Security.
That's exactly right.
You see, prior to the Social Security, the family had much more interest in transmitting particular values, because after all, it was to their economic interest to have those values. It's no longer true. It's no longer
That's
of economic
right.
interest necessarily. And again, this cuts back on the discount rate and on prudence and so forth. I mean, on savings and all of these things come in. It's all very closely connected together. And I think this is a useful way or a useful avenue for economics to explore. At one point in some of your recent writings, you said something about that, as I remember, it said something about our tools have overwhelmed us. And in a sense, we have done that. I think economists have allowed themselves to be attracted by their own tools. You might want to elaborate on that just a minute as we finish.
Well, economics is a very powerful set of analytical tools and a very powerful way of reasoning about the world. And I feel that we've been seduced by that. You know, we have all this power. We can explain so much. We can do so much that nobody else can do. You know, we're like wizards. And, you know, you go and teach those principles of economics classes, and the kids are swept off their feet by all this stuff you can account for that they could never see before. And part of the way we've done that is by narrowing the field of inquiry, in a sense, and sort of shutting out certain aspects that we can't deal with. And by doing that, or by trying to take those tools as they now are, and attacking things like the family, we're distorting reality by doing that. By the things we omit, we're distorting reality in important ways. So I'm not a person who says we need to trash all of economics, because I think, you know, obviously it's a very powerful science. We've gone a long way because we focused on something about human nature that's true, namely that people are self-interested. But there are other things in human nature that are also true, and that the more we can bring those into the story, the better story we're going to have. And we need to have some courage about that, and not be afraid that we're going to lose our first bag of tools.
So, in other words, this is very interesting, because, in other words, you're saying let's not use the formal tools we have to focus on institutions that have not been focused on before, but rather let's look at the institutions and try to develop new tools that will analyze them better than the ones we
have. I think you have to do both. You have to go back and forth with that, with the tool. You know, you've got some tools that tell you what to look for in the first place. You go out and look, and you find something you didn't expect to find, like, babies, you know. Nothing in economics that prepares you for a baby. Oh, babies. Now we have to go back to the drawing board, as it were, and somehow fit that into the story. And then once you've done that, the theory's enriched by doing that. And then you've got new implications and new things that you're going to be looking for. And you go back and you look again. So for me, the inductive-deductive dichotomy has never been very strong. I've always been an advocate of going back and forth with that approach.
Well, thank you very much. This has been an interesting conversation.
Thank you, Jim.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.